This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, say to language, "Hey, how's it going?" And language says, "Oh, sorry, we met." And I say, "Yeah, we work together, we see each other every day." And language says, Let's prepare ourselves for today's show with a little light word history. And with Valentine's Day strutting briskly towards us, here's the etymology of wedlock, which has meant marriage since the early 13th century, but it evolved from the old English word wedlack, in which the wed meant a pledge, and lack was a suffix that denoted an action, so wedlock was making a pledge. Nothing to do with actual locks, so put away your old ball and chain jokes, firstly, because you're not living in a 70s sitcom, and secondly, just because a word looks like another word, it doesn't mean they're related, so wedlock is also not related to warlock. What they've got in common is having a last syllable that sounded a bit like lock, so eventually people started spelling it lock. Warlock started out as the Old English wa-loga, which meant a traitor or liar. Wa meant fidelity or vow, but the loga meant lie. So while wedlock was making a pledge, warlock was breaking a pledge. Wa-loga also used to sometimes refer to the devil. And by extension, it came to mean people who associated with the devil, and thus by the 1500s, it was a word for sorcerers. And it's now considered by some pagans to be an offensive term. And fair enough, just because you're a gentleman witch doesn't mean you're evil. Not all warlocks. On with the show.
Hello there, stranger. Come on in and welcome to my profile.
Heteroflexible, woman, single, 5'8", average build. Never smokes, drinks socially, has dogs, Scorpio.
Exotic, altruistic, honest, kind, professional woman who likes really good pie, used bookstores, conversations with small children.
My passions are board games, night animation, skies, and overanalyzing
being
everything.
By the ocean.
And I'm always up for something new.
World trivia, bail forts, and perhaps you. Tell me about your mind.
Software developer seeking retired astronaut.
Outdoorsy nerd, born in Northern City. Raised in Southern City. You're intellectual, but fun. You're a fun-tellectual.
I value curiosity and empathy in a well-made burrito.
Happily non-monogamous, in search of a main squeeze.
I'd like to date a man who is affectionate, intelligent, and encouraging.
Into other masculine fellas, usually younger or up to my age, rarely into other bearry guys.
I like books, food, booze, tattoos, and assonance.
I'm polyamorous and pansexual, which is pretty cool. I'm looking for another partner on here, or at least a few new friends.
Seeking male with record-breaking low standards.
I spend a lot of time thinking about
politics, sex,
how to arrange my bookshelves,
what the insides of people's homes look like,
how to get a better job,
the impending doom of the human race,
how to live the dream,
gentrification,
cats.
I spend a lot of time thinking about
budgeting,
boning.
The first thing people usually notice about me is my brightly colored socks, or my height, depending on if they go top to bottom or the other way around.
The first thing people usually notice about me, bitch face.
The most private thing I'm willing to admit section. I've been working on a long-term painting project in my room without ventilation, which may or may not have been the best idea.
The most private thing I'm willing to admit, I can't swim or whistle.
I'm in love with my therapist. Transference is pretty common, so there's no need to be jealous.
Most private thing I'm willing to admit, I left that section totally blank.
If you've read this far, I want to give you a high five.
Let's get to know each other.
There's a good chance I'll swipe right if there's a dog in your profile.
I'm really interested in non-binary people, couples, and other trans folk. Cis women as well. Any other folk can feel free to talk to me also.
Don't just see me a message that says hi and nothing else.
Please don't message me if you're a couple looking for a third. I'm really only interested in one-on-one relationships.
Not sure if I want romance, but if I do, it won't start because a guy texts me, "My sausage wants a date in your knickers, love."
Much as I like penises, I'd rather see a pic of your face if we're going to be talking, thanks.
You should message me if you like burritos.
My dating profile is just one sentence. It says, "Just looking for a nice girl to sit quietly in a dark room and think about death with." Gotten some pretty weird responses to that one.
Those are all real dating profiles of illusionist listeners. And they're the online iteration of a tradition that has been around a lot longer than the internet.
I found them right back to 1695, which really, you know, gives one a good 300 years of evidence about, you know, how humans find a mate, which is sort of amazingly revealing and hilarious.
Francesca Bowman is a historian and the author of Shapely Ankle Preferred, A History of the Lonely Hearts Ad. And that first Lonely Hearts ad, which appeared on the 19th of July 1695 on page 3 of a pamphlet being sold around London.
A gentleman, about 30 years of age, that says he has a very good estate, would willingly match himself to some good gentlewoman that has a fortune of £300 or thereabouts, and he will make a settlement to content.
There's actually an even more revealing ad a few lines down that says,
a young man, about 25 years of age, in a very good trade, and whose father will make him worth £1,000, would willingly embrace his beautiful match. He's been brought up a dissenter with his parents and is a sober man.
So, you know, also important to be sober, I suppose.
And dissenting.
And exactly.
Professional and amateur matchmakers had been around for a very long time. So why did the people of Britain start looking for partners in newspapers?
As soon as one got the first newspapers and magazines, one got the first Lonely Hearts ad. So they all emerged together. It was really in the 1690s that in London, suddenly the streets were full of newspapers and magazines. Print really took off in a big way. So as soon as you got those, people saw the opportunity for advertising. And also at the same time, lots of people were moving to the city, facing all the problems that we face today. You know, they were working really hard, working really long hours, too busy to meet people. They didn't have their sort of mum or their sister around to introduce them to the girl next door.
So if men wanted to meet someone, they had to come up with another way. And women were allowed to spend more time with newspapers than they were with single men. So I can see that it would have worked for them, but what was in it for the newspapers?
Selling more copies of newspapers. So really, very quickly, newspaper proprietors spotted the entertainment value of Lonely Hearts ads. And which means within just a few short decades, Lonely Hearts ads often started appearing on the front page of the newspaper. So from when the Times newspaper was founded in the 1790s, the Times had Lonely Hearts ads on its front page right from the beginning. They're hilarious or sad. They get people talking. Did you see that ad on the front page of the paper? Who do you think placed it? What will happen? You know, there's a great sense of intrigue and romance surrounding these ads. So they're these chunks of people's lives right there in black and white. And there's so much in there, people's innermost needs and desires right there in the newspaper. It's a brilliant way of selling more newspaper copies.
These ads document what Brits have been looking for in a partnership over the past 300 years.
Certainly in the beginning, the ads were pretty simple. They wanted, a man wanted a woman who was young and ideally had some money. And a woman wanted a man who had some money. And that was it. Lots of the language that men will use in their ads is really just different ways of saying fertile. So they'll say healthy, they'll say glowing, they'll say young. And a lot of the language that women use is just different ways of saying has money to support offspring. There were certain criteria that did reappear in all the ads because in an evolutionary sense, that's what people look for. In an evolutionary sense, men did look for women who were basically fertile, and women did look for men who had resources. The evolutionary needs of that do often trump all the many other romantic factors. For so many centuries, marriage had just been a business transaction. There was one in the Dorset County Chronicle in 1824 that said, I want a woman to look after the pigs while I'm out at work. So it's not just about the money in a sort of basic sense. It's about everything that surrounds money, like the labour costs, the property costs, all of that. People were very straightforward because, you know, that was important.
It strikes me that at this time, the men placing the ads were looking for something long term, whereas the women responding to them needed a solution to an immediate problem. Single women were very limited in what they could do, how they could live, what they could earn and own, whom they could spend time with. Marriage opened up more possibilities, even if those possibilities were looking after someone else's pigs. But as time goes on, the ads show that people did start expecting other things from marriage.
They really reflect the rise of romantic love in the 18th century. It's not just a business transaction to benefit the community. So with this, the ads become more intimate and more detailed about what people are looking for, whether it's the way they look or dancing. So that really changes. Again, in terms of the physical appearance, the language used change a lot. So in the 18th century, you get people asking for a woman with a shapely ankle or a man with a well-shaped head. I don't think you'd get that very often with online dating today.
I wonder what is a well-shaped head?
I think it was all tied up with phrenology, which was all about how the shape of your head very much determined your character. Also, of course, because you used to pay for the ads by the word, it was in the interest of the advertiser to keep them short. There was one ad that said, she must be under 40, not deformed. And that was it. Those were the only criteria. Whereas with the advent of the internet, where ads are not charged by the word, that changes enormously. It means you can write the world's longest laundry list of what you're looking for in a man or a woman. And there'd be no drawbacks to that, except for, you know, it really exposes how much choosier people are today when they're looking for a mate.
There were a couple of important developments in the 19th century. One, the advent of mass education and therefore mass literacy. So advertisers weren't just men from fairly high social strata, and more women were able to read the ads. And two, the notion of marrying for love really caught on. The marital bliss of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert made a lot of their subjects think they could and should seek happiness and personal fulfilment. Although being more emotional didn't necessarily come easily to Victorian Britain.
Love and marriage had always been a very, very private entity. It all happened behind closed doors, really. Throughout the 19th century, it became, of course, more public. There it is on the front page of the newspaper, people expressing their innermost needs and desires about what they look for in a man or what they look for in a woman, and that made people uncomfortable. I mean, you know, the Victorians weren't as private as I think history has made them out to be, but certainly there was a sense that this might cause the social order to break down, and that caused a lot of fear and panic amongst newspaper proprietors and really all the way up to government, because there was a sense that marriage was the bedrock of society. So if the way people got married collapsed or took a different form, then what? Where would we be? Chaos. It was very much about trying to keep people in their place.
Lonely Hearts ads were so popular, in April 1870, the first newspaper launched that was entirely filled with them. The Matrimonial News announced itself with this statement: "Civilization, combined with the cold formalities of society and the rules of etiquette, imposes such restrictions on the sexes that there are thousands of marriageable men and women of all ages capable of making each other happy who never have a chance of meeting." And almost immediately, there were stacks of rival Lonely Hearts newspapers: the Matrimonial Gazette, the Matrimonial Post, the Matrimonial Times, the Matrimonial Register, the Matrimonial Chronicle, the Matrimonial Courier, Matrimonial World.
The ads were at their most popular in the 1890s. They really reached their peak. I mean, London alone had over 20 matrimonial newspapers on the streets. So this was newspapers entirely dedicated to Lonely Hearts ads. Thousands and thousands and thousands of ads.
Including rather a lot of fake ads. The marital newspapers had pages to fill and expectations to falsely raise. And anyway, since the beginning, fakery had been a characteristic of the Lonely Hearts ads. Here's one from the Times in 1786.
"A gentleman of very considerable fortune, about the age of 40, though he possesses an excellent and unimpaired constitution, is afflicted with an incurable weakness in his knees, occasioned by the kick of an ostrich in the East Indies."
You know this dreamboat is too good to be true, because there were no ostriches in the East Indies at the time. Unless East Indies is a euphemism. In the first couple of hundred years of Lonely Hearts, advertisers might have used words like respectable or delicate to describe the woman they wanted, but by the early 20th century, the vocabulary had become more lively.
"Lothario, London West, 30, ex-officer. Wants cuddlesome girls fond of rivers, dancing, pleasure."
Cuddlesome is brilliant. I mean, they're all, it really shows the range of human desire, I think, in terms of the different things that people look for.
And the early 20th century woman was looking for different things too. Many were rejecting the Victorian ideal that they should be a wedlocked baby machine. And they could upturn courtship conventions by pursuing rather than waiting to be pursued. Maybe they wanted nothing more from a suitor than sex and fun, and they'd make that clear in their ads with terms like bachelor girl and sporty. And some of the words in the ads were code to indicate people were seeking same-sex partners, which back then they couldn't do openly because homosexuality was still a prisonable offence. Francesca reckons there may have been gay Lonely Hearts ads for as long as there have been Lonely Hearts ads, but it's difficult to prove because the advertisers had to be so guarded, and the code words might only have been recognisable to others in the same situation. But some of the code is not that hard to spot. Adjectives like unconventional, Byronesque, theatrical.
Code words that today would be thought of as very sort of cliched in many ways and playing up to stereotypes. They would say things like autistic man looks for somebody who loves Oscar Wilde, that kind of thing, that today would seem very stereotyped. But in the early days when gay culture was fighting its way out of a very constrained world, these ads were necessary and did play a very, very important role.
But the clandestine gay ads also contributed to the scandalous reputation of Lonely Hearts. They had always been quite inflammatory, summoning fears of respondents being financially or emotionally defrauded, and the ads had been implicated in murder cases, money thefts, bigamy, and cult recruitment. The negative perception of the ads was further reinforced because you never really heard about the ones that had a positive outcome with no drama, whereas the newspapers loved printing the bad news stories.
Because two people who met through the Lonely Hearts ads fell in love and lived happily ever after. Who's interested in that? What people like to read about over breakfast is the tragic story of a man defrauding an innocent young woman on Piccadilly Circus.
The bad reputation was one of the things that nearly scuppered Lonely Hearts ads in the 20th century. Of those matrimonial newspapers that had started up since 1870, all but two of them were gone by the end of World War II. The World Wars irrevocably changed the social order and human connections were becoming somewhat easier to make in person. Then in the 1950s and 60s, marriage agencies became more popular than Lonely Hearts ads because they were seen as more trustworthy. But although they were no longer on the front page, there were still Lonely Hearts ads in newspapers and magazines. And in the 1970s, the word limit saving acronyms arrived, like GSOH and WLTM. And that's also the time when gay and lesbian ads could start to appear openly. And in general, people were being far more frank about what they were seeking sexually or romantically.
There was one in Private Eye in 1973 that said, £50 for temporary relationship resulting in pregnancy. Super straightforward. And then other ones that were very sexually liberated. You know, they want someone like freedom-seeking and radical, they'll say.
As they so often do, advances in technology shaped the form. Newspapers began to offer phone messaging, then video messaging. And then in the mid-90s, along came the first online dating sites. Launched in 1995, Match.com usually claims the credit for being the first proper dating site. And now there are thousands, from academic singles to Zoosk. Thanks to digital photography, a lot of online dating now emphasises the visual over the verbal. But the words still matter.
There are amazing statistics about, for example, if you put that you like walks on the beach, you're more likely to get lots of responses.
It's so hackneyed, isn't it?
Isn't it?
I suppose you don't seem threatening if that's what you've said.
It's such a weird thing in a way to put walks on the beach because, I don't know, I mean, everyone likes walks on the beach, so it's sort of slightly meaningless.
Well, also, unless you live on the beach, how often are you going to actually have one?
Exactly. Not often at all. So it's sort of a meaningless thing to put in the profile.
It's odd, this disconnect with like trying to be truthful about yourself to get somebody who really can love you and you can love. But yeah, on the other hand, having to lie to do that.
Yes, exactly. Well, lie's a bit strong, but certainly show one's best self, as Oprah would say. All sorts of advertising is based on some sort of white lie or half-truth. You know, no one places an ad that says, I've got giant thighs and I just lost my job and I can't cook. You know, no one places an ad like that. We all want to present our best selves.
Presenting our best selves. I've got an absolute humdinger of an episode about that, so you'd better come back next week to hear it. Francesca Bowman has written several books, including Shapely Ankle Preferred, A History of the Lonely Hearts Ad, and now she's working on a sequel about Lonely Hearts ads in the USA. Apparently they're a bit less coy than Victorian Brits. What a surprise! This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Thanks to Martin Austwick for the music, Matthew Crosby for his voice, and particularly to all the listeners and friends who shared their online dating profiles. Before I go, your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is... extraposition, noun, grammar. The placing of a word or group of words outside or at the end of a clause while retaining the sense. E.g., it's no use crying over spilt milk. Try using it in an email today. And try finding me on Facebook and Twitter at Allusionist Show and at theallusionist.org, where I'll be back next week with part 2.